You're listening to sermon audio from Redeemer Georgetown. For more information about Redeemer Georgetown, connect with us on social media or check us out at www.redeemergeorgetown.com.
Redeemer Georgetown, before we jump into the sermon, I'm going to leave that over there. I'm going to walk over here, and I want to say this. A moment ago, I jumped up, prayed about just distracted hearts, and then sat down over there while we're singing and feel like the Lord in his gentle but direct way just whispered into my heart, "You're the chief distractor or distracted." Felt like the Lord asked, "Man, did you go through the motions this morning, rushing through editing a sermon to get up here? Yes. Did you stop and have focused prayer over the people that are gathering today? No." And I just wanted to confess that and repent of it before you. That's it. I know this is an awkward transition. It is what it is. Okay. If we haven't met, my name is Brandon. We are jumping into a sermon series on the book of Proverbs. The plan is Proverbs 1 through 5 to take us into the building. That is the plan. Yeah, be excited. Now, we may end up preaching, if you're a betting man or a betting woman on here, I would bet on us preaching Proverbs 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe 21, 22, 23 as well. But the plan is Proverbs 1, 1 through 5 as we make our way into the building. Now, the book of Proverbs. I don't think it's an overstatement. I don't think it's hyperbole for me to say to you that one of the more perplexing, confusing, frustrating, I'm disinterested with you books of the Bible for me over the years was Proverbs. And here's why. I read the book of Proverbs. I didn't grow up in the church. I was 22, became a Christian. It took me several years before I opened one page of the Old Testament. That's a long, separate story. When I did, I read Proverbs, and I read it as just a series of do's and don'ts. Like, do this and don't do this. No, like, big, grand vision of God. No Romans theology. Just, hey, son, do this and don't do this. And I thought, boring. And then one day, I'm studying Proverbs, probably because I was forced to. I don't know. And I came across this theologian who said, listen, if you think of the Proverbs as a series of do's and don'ts, you're missing it entirely. The Proverbs are how the people of Israel would go out and live the law. The law with its clear black and white do's and don'ts. The Proverbs is the wisdom literature and how you take the law and then you go out and you make decisions in life and you live out, you embody your faith in the world. That the book of Proverbs, it's not a set of promises, they're proverbs. They're proverbially true statements. They're generally true. And so my goal today is to preach Proverbs 1, but in such a way that we're setting up the series on the book of Proverbs. Sound good? Now, before you say yes, let me say this. Typically, a team with two quarterbacks has how many quarterbacks? Okay, that was, when I point to you, that means you. A team with two quarterbacks has how many quarterbacks?
Zero.
You try to preach two sermons, you generally end up with zero, and so we'll let you decide on that in a minute. But here's what I want to do. I want to frame up this sermon and this series like this. With this question. What do you do when you don't know what to do? What do you do when you don't know what to do? Now, to be clear, I'm talking about you've got two options. Two options that are morally neutral. One option, morally neutral. The other option, morally neutral, and you don't know what to do. This is not my neighbor won't take care of their lawn, I'm angry, and so I'm thinking about graffitiing their house. That is not what we're talking about right here. This is, I've got two choices in front of me. I don't know which is the right one. I don't know which is the good one. What do I choose? Because here's what we know. We know life is not like using Google Maps. Right? Google Maps, you punch in the destination, it routes you there. It will reroute you when there's a wreck or traffic up in front. It will even tell you when there's cops up there waiting for you. Life often feels like we don't have our destination clearly in mind. And we certainly don't have the route to get where we don't know we're going clearly mapped out for us. That in life we have to make decisions that have consequences. Making decisions in real life decisions that have consequences It's difficult. There's a great episode, season 5 of The Office, greatest TV show of all time. Michael Scott's Stanley has a heart attack, or presumably heart attack. I think it was a heart attack. And his solution is, I've got an idea. I've been tough on these people. I'm going to have them roast me. I'm going to let them roast me. And then they roast him, and then what does he do? He walks out crying and goes and sits and feeds pigeons by a lake. Why? Because he said, I got a decision, and he did not think through the consequences of it. Making decisions without thinking about consequences, it's difficult, and it's complicated, and it takes wisdom. It takes wisdom. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at Proverbs 1 under these headings. What wisdom is, why you need it, and how you get it. So what it is, why you need it, how you get it. All right, look at verse 2 with me. Proverbs 1, 2. To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Okay, stop right there. If you want to understand a term in the Bible, in particular in the wisdom literature, which obviously Proverbs is part of, here's a formula. Formulas generally aren't good with the Bible. Here's an approach. Let me back up and say it that way. Here's one approach. One, define the term. And then two, look for the synonyms. Look for the words around it that explain it. Okay? So let's define the word wisdom, and then let's look at the synonyms around it, or the explainer words that are around wisdom to explain what it means. So if we just defined it, if we open up the Hebrew dictionary with the word that we translate wisdom, you're going to find this. You're going to find things like shrewdness. Shrewdness. The ability to make sound judgments. The ability to kind of be in the midst of a situation, a circumstance, and you've got to think soundly and then make a judgment or decision to be sound in your judgment. And then one of the more interesting ones that was in there was this, skill in war. I'm quoting that from the Hebrew dictionary. Skill in war. Why in the world would skill in war be there in part of the definition for the Hebrew word wisdom? Here's why. Have you ever heard of the phrase fog of war? Yeah. Fog of war, where everything is foggy. It's confusing. You can't see straight. You don't know what's around the corner. And in the midst of that, you have to make decisions. You're in the middle of the fog of war, where you just, everywhere, you don't know what's around the corner. You can't see everything. Nothing is clear. And in the midst of that uncertainty and confusion, the fog of war, you've got to make real life decisions. Decisions that have consequences for your troops. One of my favorite examples of this and stories is Abraham Lincoln in the midst of the Civil War trying to both end slavery and keep the country together. That dude had to make a lot of wise decisions in the midst of serious fog of war. So, shrewdness, skill in war. And then the synonyms. What's around it? There's four words that sort of sit around the word wisdom here. Instruction, insight, prudence, knowledge. Let's take them one at a time. Instruction. The Hebrew word is musar. It's something that you gain through observing, reflecting on the suffering of others. Musar, instruction. It's the kind of instruction that forms depth of character. And you get it, you gain it, not just through reading books. It's actually a kind of instruction you can't get through reading books. Books are good. I like books. It's the kind of instruction, the kind of depth of character that you get through navigating real life and seeing the suffering of somebody else and learning from it. And then insight. Insight is a wonderful translation of the word insight, to have sight into, to see inside of, to get inside of. To not be on the surface of, to maybe be able to get into, in the middle of, and understand. Maybe it's an argument somebody is trying to make. Maybe it's your own emotions. But not being on the surface of them, not on the outside of them, but being able to just sort of see into, to get into the middle of, to have insight into. And then prudence. The word translated prudence here, it means practical, it's strategic, it's being able to get things done. It's looking out and seeing a goal that you want to accomplish, and then being able to accomplish that goal through problem solving along the way. I'm prudent in my decision making, in my problem solving, in effort to accomplish something. And then knowledge. Knowledge, this is probably my favorite one of the four. Insight, I think, is a lot of fun, but knowledge, think discernment. Think being able to see and have knowledge of something that's not completely clear. This is the same word from Genesis 2, the knowledge, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If you go back to then, if we put ourselves in Genesis 2, there is no legal code of what is right and wrong yet. Only one. There's not the, this is what is good and this is what is evil. It's hey, if you eat of this, you're going to look at it, you're going to have knowledge of what is good and evil without it being clear. Think discernment. When you put them together, when you take that definition, the synonyms, put them together, here's what wisdom is. Bruce Waltke, probably my favorite commentator on the book of Proverbs, on a lot of the Old Testament, in particular Proverbs, he says this. This is his definition for biblical wisdom. Key phrase, biblical wisdom, we're going to come back to that one later in the sermon. Here's what he says. He defines it this way. The skill of living in harmony with God's created order. The skill of living in harmony with God's created order. Gerhard von Rad put it this way. He said it's competence with the realities of life, with how life really works. It's knowing how, going out in the world, knowing how to make decisions when the moral rules don't always apply. All right, so sometimes there is a clear moral right and a moral wrong. That doesn't take a lot of wisdom. Do I steal from my company or do I not? Does not take wisdom. But most of life's decisions don't have clear moral rights and wrongs. Some certainly do. The majority do not. When I teach leadership in any setting, one of the sessions I teach, it's titled Escaping the Right-Wrong Paradigm, Learning to Make Decisions. Because most decisions don't have clear rights and wrongs, and we've got to be able to escape it. In that leadership setting, we talk about informed versus uninformed. Here, it's wise versus unwise. How do we make wise decisions? How do we make decisions when there's not a clear right or wrong? Let me give some examples. Some examples from parenting, right? We want to raise our kids to go out into the world and be able to make decisions in a world full of gray. Graduating high school, going to college versus getting a job. There's not a right or a wrong. How do we make a decision? How do we know what's good or better or best? How about this one for parents of teenagers? The age to start letting them date. In my house, it's 43. I'm not kidding. It's 34. I'm joking. What about this one? Homeschool versus public versus private. No shortage of opinions on the right one. When Isley, our oldest, was approaching starting kindergarten, I mean, the people around us were passionate. And I mean passionate on all sides of the argument, all sides of the conversation. That one too we'll come back to. Maybe some professional examples. The obvious, do I take this job or do I take that job? Right, sometimes we're unemployed and we have one job, it's pretty obvious. Sometimes we're employed and we end up with two jobs, or we're unemployed and then we get two job offers and we don't know which one to take. We take this one, we take that one. Or maybe this one. you're mid-career. Say you're in your 30s, early 40s maybe even. And you just look up and go, I absolutely hate what I'm doing. I'm miserable. Should I go back to school or find a way to just start over in a different career? It's not a right or a wrong. How do we decide? Or relationship skills. Man, you've got somebody in your community, somebody in maybe what we call a gospel community, which is where we, if you're new to our church, it's just kind of where we live our life, right? We meet together midweek, we have a meal together, we pray together, we talk about the sermon together, and then we hang out together. You see somebody in your relationship circles, and you think, man, something's off, and I need to engage. How do I engage? How do I do it? When do I do it? What do I say? No clear rights or wrongs. These take wisdom. Most of life, there are not clear rights and wrongs. Wisdom is knowing how to make decisions when life isn't clear. Knowing how to make decisions when life isn't clear, when there's not a clear right, not a clear wrong. Going out in life, making decisions. It's competence with real life. That's what it is. Now, why do we need it? Why do we need wisdom? Well, under why do we need it, I'm going to give you two reasons and then two choices. Okay? Two reasons first. To talk about the first reason, we need to define and talk about who the simple and the fool are in the Proverbs. So verse 4, to give prudence a simple. 7, fools despise wise wisdom and instruction. So who are the simple and who are the fool? Okay. The simple. These are the people who are young and naive, right? Young and naive. They're unrooted. They don't know how to make smart decisions. They're not able yet to think critically about life or the decision in front of them. Generally speaking, these are referencing people who are kind of go with the crowd people, follow along people. I think what you think so that I can belong. These are generally speaking, people who probably would just, you would describe them as people who care too much what everybody else around them thinks. One mark of a naive person is that they follow the passion, right? So let's go back to that example of Isley is about to hit kindergarten age. All around us are people with great conviction, in particular about private school, homeschool, and public school. Wisdom would say this. It would say, listen, you need to think critically and not just follow the most passionate person out there. But when you're young, when you're naive, you look out and you see the passion. You see somebody who just really believes what they're saying. And you say, oh, man, I'm drawn to that passion. If they believe that, that's where I'm at. That's naive. It's young. It's youthful. Following passion and thinking critically are different. The simple, the naive, follow passion, not think critically about what's in front of them, not think through the options. And then the fool, the fool is almost the opposite. The fool is wise in their own eyes, self-righteous, stubborn. The person who doesn't care enough what people around them think of them, refuse correction. They won't listen to what other people have to say to them, in particular about them. And the reason that it's needed, reason one, is that the simple fool is our default. The simple fool is our default. It's who you're born. You were born a simple fool. By Proverbs 22, folly or foolishness bound up in the heart of a child. It's hardwired into all of us. Right, generally speaking, most people start out simple, following puberty hits, and all of a sudden, man, I'm a walking encyclopedia. I remember me as an example. I remember being in sixth, approaching seventh grade, and really like thinking highly of my teachers, in particular in math. I thought, man, they're really smart. I love how they figure this stuff out. I even thought my parents, my mom, knew some of what she was talking about. Somewhere on eighth, ninth grade, all of a sudden, no, man, I was sitting in class. I legit thought, lady, you don't know what you're talking about. Do you want me to teach the class for you? Same thing with parents. Simple fool is our default. That's reason one. Reason two, life without wisdom is dangerous. And I'm not being philosophical with the word dangerous. There's a shift in chapter 1 from 7 to 8, where we go from the introduction into the rest of sort of the meat of the proverb, if I could say it that way, where it becomes the father to a son, the father pleading with a son not to be the simple fool. And pick it up in verse 10, he says this, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us,' come with us. Let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason." So here's the scene. You've got the son saying to his father, "Hey, listen, if these people come to you and say, 'Hey, come join us, come jump in with us,' and you know, man, their greed is driving them. They're out for unjust gain. That becomes clear in the text, the next few verses. Don't jump in. Look, son, I know you need friends. I know you want friends. I know you want to fit in. I know you want to belong. Not there, son. Please listen to me. Not there. Not there. Don't go there. Son, this isn't the way. I know you need friends. This is not the way. And here's why. Jump down to verse 18. I know we didn't read this earlier. He says, "But these men," speaking of the ones who, son, are trying to entice you to come with them, "these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors." Did you see that? Did you see that? "Hey, son, listen, I know these guys are driven by greed. And I know what they're going to do. And I know they're saying to you, 'Son, jump on in. Come on in. Come with us.' But son, listen, here is what happens. When greed drives at them, they don't just ruin somebody else's life, they ruin their own. They're ruining their own life." Again, this is not philosophy. He uses the language of they are ambushing their own lives. My father drafted into the Vietnam War. For all of his life, I only got him to talk about his time over there twice. Once, very brief glance at it. The second time he told me about a time when their convoy was ambushed. He described the scene of the trucks going along and then being in one of the front half of the convoy, and as they passed through, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, everybody came in, attacking them from all angles. A handful of them survived. He was one of them. And the writer of the Proverbs is saying, listen, when you let greed drive you and you jump in with these guys, son, they're setting an ambush to their own lives, being attacked themselves from everywhere. Don't do it, son. And again, this is not philosophy. How many of you know somebody? How many of you know somebody who's driven by greed in their younger years, who you look at and go, man, they look like they're getting happier as they get older? You ever seen that? Me neither. Greed destroys, the proverb is saying. You and everyone around you. Most of us know this. So what's the problem? Verse 22, "How long, O simple ones," listen to this language. "How long, O simple ones, will you love being simple? How long will scoffers delight in their scoffing and fools hate knowledge?" How long will you love being simple? Hey, fools, how long will you hate knowledge, the kind of knowledge that produces depth of character, maturity? How long will you hate it? I read this verse in preparing for this, and I just could not get my head around what in the world this verse is doing here. Bruce Waltke, super helpful, said it this way. "Love designates the emotional feeling of strongly desiring something. They remain uncommitted to the Lord, and so remain open to the allure of sin." His point is this, that their love for the taste of greed has not been superseded with a love for the Lord. And so they continue loving and hating because sin is enticing, greed tastes good. It tastes like the life that you want. Like there's a moment where greed tastes good or we wouldn't eat it. If it didn't taste good, we wouldn't take a second bite. We might take a first bite, but if we didn't like the way that first bite tastes, we wouldn't take the second bite. Which takes us to our two choices. Here are your two choices. Here are my two choices. You can grow in wisdom or make a wreck of your life as you get older. Everyone starts a simple fool, and it is possible to grow in wisdom. It is also possible to grow old and stay young at the same time. How can I self-identify if this is me growing older and staying young at the same time, i.e. remaining the simple fool? Let me illustrate. Let me give two examples, two illustrations, try to help you self-identify and maybe see yourself a bit in the stories. One of them is from last year. I was mediating a family situation. Darn it, I meant to not say family. Mediating a situation from my family, too late now, where a son didn't want his mother at his wedding, and the mother didn't want to come to the wedding. What happened was she had said something. It offended the fiancé. Nobody had adult conversations about it. When you do that, what happens? It festers. Eventually, it blows up. When I sat down with her, I'm in a living room and saying, listen, I'm going to walk you through the pattern of your life. This was 30 years ago, this happened. And then 15 years ago, this, and now this. The response was, I'm me. I'm not changing me for anyone. I am who I am, and you can take it or you can leave it. And my answer was, listen, if that's your approach to life, eventually people leave it. And you wind up lonely as you get old. So here's one way. Here's one way to identify, is this me? When you're 40, do you refuse to listen to somebody who's 20? When a 20-year-old sits down to say, hey, listen, I see this in your life, do you look at him and say, are you kidding me? You're 20 years old. Or do you say, maybe you're saying something I need to hear? When you're 50, do you refuse to listen to somebody who's 30 or 60, 40, 70, 50, and so on? Is the narrative of your life, I am who I am, and I'm not changing for anyone. Take it or leave it. Well, here's another one. I do hope that if this example here presses on you and you feel a little bit targeted right now, I hope you feel that. Why do you think social media algorithms are as effective as they are? Why do you think they are as good as they are at sucking people in, working you into a rage, and then sending you off to suck other people in and work them into a rage? Why do you think they're as good at that as they are? The answer is because most people get old but never grow up. And if you find yourself on social media and you see a post and you just get angry, and you think to yourself, the world needs to hear what I have to say about this. I'm taking on the world through my keyboard. In that moment, you're being the simple fool for somebody else's profit in such a way that does not profit your soul at all or the world. You can grow old without growing up. And if you do, and your life does not grow in wisdom, you end up destroying yourself from the inside out. So then, question three, how do we get it? If that's what it is, that's why it's so important, how do we get wisdom? Well, the answer sits right in the heart of this proverb, verses 7 through 9. Look at verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Okay, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Every commentator I could find agreed on one thing. This right here is the theological heartbeat of the book of Proverbs. This is the theological foundation. Everything in the book of Proverbs grows on top of this. It grows out of this, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now, here's what's interesting. It's at least strange that fear is a positive thing here. Right? Usually in the Bible, you see fear, it tends to be a negative, or treated as a negative, right? Perfect love casts out fear. God has not given us a spirit of fear. Why is fear a positive thing here? There's other places in the Bible it's a positive thing, but it stands out as odd that fear of the Lord would produce wisdom, that fear is treated as a positive thing here. Well, the answer is that there is a negative kind of fear and a positive kind of fear. There are two ways of being afraid in the presence of someone. One is I'm afraid of you. Like, I'm afraid of you. I'm afraid you're going to hurt me. I'm afraid what you're going to say to me. I'm afraid what you're going to do to me. And so I'm afraid of you. The second is I'm in awe of you. I kind of tremble in your presence. It's what Amanda felt the first time she saw me. God, that was way funnier, y'all. But it is the difference in a healthy marriage, is it not? I'm afraid of Amanda. I'm afraid of her leaving. I'm afraid of versus I'm afraid of dishonoring her. I'm afraid of not caring for her. I'm afraid of not making her be seen and valued and treated the way that she should be because I'm in awe of her. See, the negative fear, it's about me. I don't want you to hurt me. The positive fear is about you. I want to honor you. I want to exalt you. I want you to be treated the way that you should. And so the fear of the Lord, it's not I'm afraid of him. It's I'm in awe. I want to honor. And out of that honor, sin becomes less enticing. Greed doesn't taste as good. That this, the fear of the Lord, I want to honor the Lord. This is the beginning of wisdom, but it's not the end. Keep reading verses 8 and 9. Hear, my son, your father's instructions, and forsake not your mother's teaching. For they are a graceful garland for your head and pendants for your neck. Now, there's layers to the wisdom literature in the Bible, to most of the Bible. Everybody, I think, theologically, commentators all would agree that here's both the collective Israel, the spiritual lineage, and then an actual father to a son. So both individual and collective happening right here. And so when he says, hear your father, embrace your mother, here's what's going on. Hear is to internalize, right? Hear your father, not just listen to, not just regurgitate, but actually take the words of your father and internalize them into you. And then forsake, it's don't abandon, don't walk away from your mother. These words, the instruction of your mother, the words of your father, hearing them, they're meant to be graceful garland and a pendant. And in ancient Israel, these were symbolic. This was symbolic language going on right here, that it was symbolic of honor and life and power and beauty. And what the text is saying is, here's how we get wisdom. You want to get wisdom? It starts with the fear of the Lord. It starts with wanting to honor the Lord. And then staying close to the words of your father and your mother. But this forces a question upon us, does it not? What do I do? What do I do if the truth is that I don't fear the Lord? Like, honoring the Lord is not what really governs my life. I'm interested in Christianity. I'm here. I'm at least a little bit curious. But I'm certainly not trying to honor the Lord. In fact, I still maybe have fear of God a little bit in my life. And then, what if my father's words weren't safe? What if my mother's were painful? What if Like if my mom were here right now, and you got an honest moment from her, and you said, "Hey, describe what life was like growing up with your mom," she would say, "Listen, my mom, like she would pawn it off and say, 'Oh, she's a great grandmother.' Okay, get beyond that and get to the truth of stuff." She would say, "Yeah." Her words were they weren't comforting and they weren't safe. They were much more like an axe and a dagger. What if, one, I don't fear the Lord, two, maybe I'm trying to, but I hear this, stay close to your mother, hear your father, but their words for me weren't safe. They really were much more like the axe and the dagger for me. What do I do? Here's my answer. My answer is learn to argue. In the book of Hebrews, in chapter 12, there's a place where the Bible says, I want you to argue with me. In verse 5, Hebrews 12, verse 5, it reads like this. Don't try to turn there. Just read it. It says, "And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons?" The word addresses, it's the Greek word for argue. Like a wooden literal translation of this verse would say, "Have you forgotten the exhortation that argues with you as a son?" And then you know what the verse does? It goes on to quote the Proverbs. This is the second half of the verse. "My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord. Do not be weary when reproved by him." That is directly from the Proverbs. This is the Bible saying to you, hey, listen, here's what I want you to do. I want you to argue with me. The Bible inviting you to argue with the Bible, to come and have a dialogue. And keep in mind, when the word argue, you can't picture 2 9-year-olds fighting with one another. Argue is this constant dialogue, exchange, back and forth, push and pull, but it's got some maturity to it. It's not the teenage fighting over it. It's, I'm wrestling with you. I'm arguing with you. Now, here's the question. Why would the writer of Hebrews say to you, hey, here's what I want you to do. I want you to argue with me and then cite the book of Proverbs. Why? Here's the answer. Because the Bible, the story of the Bible, is about a son, the son, who truly internalized the words of his father in heaven and did not abandon his mother on earth. The words of the Bible are about that son, and the Bible is saying, come and argue with me, because the more you argue with me, the more I take you to the son. That the arc of the Bible would bend you toward the son, the one from whom true wisdom flows. That the beginning of wisdom, here's where it begins. It begins with trusting Jesus. It begins with trusting him and saying, listen, I do not want to govern my own life. I do not want to be my own Google Maps. I want to entrust you, the sovereign King of Kings and Lord of Lords, to be that for me. That is the beginning, and that is the foundation of wisdom. And wisdom begins with him, which takes us back to our original question. What do you do when you don't know what to do? What do you do when you don't know what to do? When I don't know what to do, what do you do? Here's the answer the Bible is going to give you. Make a decision. Make a decision. Make a decision. Often you hear stuff like this. You hear, I prayed, I felt peace. I felt peace, and so I went and made the decision. I'm ripping off Keller with this, so I could just quote cite him on that. Here's what he would say. He would say, listen, you're taking decision-making technique and imposing it on the Bible. That you do not always have peace about the decision. Most decisions in life, I rarely have peace about. There's a rollback 3 years, 3.5 years, 2 job offers, Redeemer Network, Austin Stone. I had no peace. None. I was afraid. In fact, the truth is, all I've done is pastor for 20 years. The idea of taking a job that was church adjacent, serving churches like this, I was afraid of it. Genuinely afraid. I needed my wife to really step in and help me make that call. We made the call. I told both sides what we decided. I got a text from a guy named Kevin, and I immediately thought, oh man, I made a mistake. I almost undid everything until my wife grabbed my phone from me. That's a true story. Here's what the Bible would say. The Bible would say, don't assume peace as a decision-making grid. It says, grow in wisdom and then make a decision. And then keep growing in wisdom and then make a decision. And then keep growing in wisdom and make a decision. And then continue growing in wisdom and make a decision. How do I keep growing in wisdom? Keep arguing. Keep arguing. Keep arguing with the Bible. Don't stop that wrestle. Don't stop the wrestle that when you do, when you argue with the Scriptures, it draws you into Jesus. That the arc of the Bible bends you toward Him. Keep arguing with the Bible. Don't stop arguing. Let that cultivate wisdom in you, and then argue with God in prayer. Argue with God in prayer. Listen, if you think it's not appropriate to argue with God in prayer, read the Psalms. I mean, dadgum, almost cover to cover. They are the author going, God, what in the world? Look around at my life. I mean, they are blanketed with psalmists arguing with God, open, honest, deep, rich argument with God in prayer. Argue with God in prayer. Like, what's the big claim about Job? It's not the content of his words, it's that he just kept saying them to God. When life is going sideways, argue with God. Don't turn and argue about God with other people necessarily. That comes next. Argue with God in prayer. And then argue with one another. Again, I'm not talking about 9-year-old spatting. Argue with one another. Be willing to argue. Be disagreeable. Put the Bible between you. Pray together and argue. Let the fear of the Lord be central. That your desire for one another is that we would honor Jesus. That we would honor and exalt Jesus in all that we do. And that from that place, from that posture, be willing to wrestle with one another, not trying to prove that I'm right, but trying to serve you as you serve me. Be willing to argue with one another, but argue like the wise, not the simple or the fool. Argue with humility that says, I have something to learn from everyone. Not, I'm just going to go with what you say, or I'm going to try to prove myself right no matter what you say. Let humility lead the way. Be willing to be corrected. Keep arguing with the Bible, with God in prayer, and with one another. And when the fear of the Lord is central in all three arguments, you will keep growing in wisdom.